The troops advanced out of the trenches, but by this time, although the sky was clear, the shells had thrown so much smoke, rubble and a reddish dust was everywhere. There was a mist too, and hardly anything was visible. One saw these figures disappear into the mist, and as they did so, so did the first shots ring out of the other side. I thought our men had got into the German trench, and so did the men that were with me. I reported as such to the division, and I said, I'm going forward, I can't really see what's happened. I got a message to stay where I was, so I stayed. Presently, as the barrage went forward, so the air cleared, and I could see what was happening. These words were written by a Captain Alan Hambro-Sparrow of the 2nd Battalion of the Royal Berkshire Regiment, and his battalion was supposed to be attacking the German-held village of Ovillers on the other side of Mash Valley. It was the Somme, the Battle of the Somme, the 1st of July 1916. Hambro-Sparrow goes on. In the distance, I saw the barrage pounding on towards Poitiers, the 3rd German line. In no man's land were heaps of dead, with Germans almost standing up in their trenches, well over the top, firing and sniping at those who had taken refuge in the shell holes. On the right, there were signs of fighting, and I saw varying signal lights go up in the trenches. Then I waited, and another brigade was ordered to resume the attack. Our order was cancelled when greater realisation came in as to what had really happened. It was the most enormous disaster. And for that particular battalion, it was an enormous disaster. Their casualties on that day were 437 as they tried to cross that wide expanse of no man's land. Today we call it Mash Valley. So welcome to another edition of my podcast. My name is Terry Wenham. I'm a battlefield guide, and my podcast is called Tales from the Battlefield. And over the last few days, I've been out on the Somme doing lots of things, really, but in particular recording some podcasts with various people that live and work out there. And this podcast is going to be features an interview with two of those people, Julie and David Thompson, who run the Number 56 Bed and Breakfast. They also serve evening meals, and they are based in a place called Labwassel. So without any more ado, let's get started on the interview, which I hope you'll enjoy. Thank you. I'm at Number 56, a Bed and Breakfast on Somme, our oasis on the Somme, in a place called Labwassel. And this place is right on the German front line of the 1st of July 1916. And I've been coming here for 10 years since Number 56 opened in 2012. But I was even coming here before that, when it was known as Mash Valley and was run by a lovely couple from Sheffield. And then Julie and David Thompson, that are here with me today, they took over this establishment in 2012, and it's gone from strength to strength. So first of all, I just wanted to say hello to David and Julie. If you'd like to introduce yourselves, please.
Okay. Hello, Terry. I'm Julie Thompson, and you're right, we're here at Number 56, and we moved to Labwassel in November 2012.
Hi, and I'm David Thompson, Julie's long-suffering husband.
Why is she long-suffering? No, we joke, but they work as a fantastic team here. They've got their different role. We'll talk about that later on. First of all, what brought you to... I know you'd been coming to the Somme for many years before you bought Number 56, when it was known as Mash Valley, but what brought you to the Somme in the first place, David?
We reached a point in our lives back in the UK where somebody said to us, you love France so much, and you spend so much time out there, you should really move there. And you're at that sort of time of life where you need to do it in the next couple of years, and you haven't got the guts to do it. So that was a bit of a challenge. So Julie went to good old Google properties for sale on the Somme, because we had no idea of house prices or anything like that. And where we are now was one of the first properties to come up. We thought, oh, blimey, I think we know that place. It's right in the heart of the battlefield. It's all about location, and that has got to be about the best place. And we made a decision to set up lock, stock and barrel and move over here.
But initially, you weren't expecting to run a bed and breakfast, if I remember correctly.
No.
No,
I was going to be a sampler of wine for various local vineyards.
Oh, right.
Julie was going to do some proper work in London.
Yeah.
But she better take over the serious side of the story.
So what happened?
Well, as David said, we hadn't thought about running a bed and breakfast, so we thought we would move out here and then come up with some kind of business plan. I thought I might even carry on working in London in the days before Zoom, this was, and kind of travel back to London when I needed to. But when we realised that the property we were looking at was a bed and breakfast, then we had a bit of a light bulb moment and thought maybe that's something we can do. We've never been in the hospitality industry before. We've never run an establishment like this. But David and I knew that it was something we could at least have a go at. And our business plan was no more than we'll give it a go. If it doesn't work, then we'll have to think about something else. And it was as complicated as that and as simple as that.
And it's gone from strength to strength there over the last 10 years, really, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. We moved in the November. We opened in March 2013. We're very keen to make it our own. So we changed the name, number 56, and people ask why number 56. That's, again, it's as simple as that's our address. We live at 56 Route de Bapaume in the village of Lavoiselle. And we just wanted to make it our own. So new name, new ethos, new website. We actually inherited Terry as one of our first guests. I think you were one of the first people to stay here with us, Terry.
That's right, yeah. I remember you calling me up and saying that we'd taken over Mash Valley, we're going to be number 56. Do you still want to come and stay?
Exactly that, yes.
And Terry made the mistake of saying, yeah, right.
You haven't been able to get rid of me
ever
since.
No, exactly. So, there we are.
So, the fact, I was going to say, why Lavoiselle, but presumably it's because it was the property, really, and the location, wasn't it? Cause it's not necessary. There was no real reason why you came to Lavoiselle. You didn't have a family connection here or anything.
No, I think the major draw was obviously the Loch na Garr crater, which is one of the reasons why we first came to this area nearly 30-odd years ago.
Right.
Helping to maintain the crater site. And I think we knew some of the villagers. They got to know us. And it just felt a very welcoming place to come and stay. You know, even if it's just for a few days before we moved here permanently. I suppose if hand on heart, excuse me, this is probably the first place I actually call home.
Really? And is that how it feels?
Yeah, it's. I've lived in all sorts of places in the UK through work and whatever other reasons. And this is the first place that, so it is home. It feels like home. I have no French connections whatsoever. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, I have no relatives who fought out here during the First World War. But it's where I just sit down and go, yeah, I'm happy now.
Really? Mm. That's great, isn't it? I mean, you've embedded yourself in the local community, haven't you? Not just in Lavoiselle, but in the local community.
Yeah, I mean,
get rid of us.
No, yeah. They've tried.
I know.
That was important to us. You know, we're firm believers that when you live in a place, you try and give back to the community. And our way of doing that was being part of the local community, whether that be in Lavoiselle, Wydell, Villers, Lavoiselle, or just locally around the Albert region. So we've always been very active and the very active in trying to give back, attending things, supporting people. During COVID lockdown, we helped some of the local school children via Zoom with their English. I mean, we're not teachers, but they enjoyed it, we enjoyed it. And again, it's about giving something back, and we're big believers in give back.
And that's why it feels so much like home, isn't it? Because you've done that over the years.
Thank you.
Yeah, it really is a lovely place to come. Everybody that comes here says the same thing, and they absolutely love it here.
Thank you.
So, as I mentioned at the start of this, Lavoiselle, for people that have been here, this is one of the most famous places on the Somme because we've got the Loch na Garr crater around the corner, and the property sits on the road between Albert and Poitiers, and the German front line actually run along the road and then turns left as you head towards Poitiers and goes in front of the neighbouring village of Auvillers.
Mm-hmm. So that the 8th Division, was it the 8th Division?
8th Division.
Division that came across Mash Valley on the 1st of July 1916 at 7:30 were wiped out, not just from machine gun fire and shell fire and rifle fire from the village of Ovillet, but from also your front garden.
Yeah.
There was a machine gun point there.
Which you can still see the indentation in the ground for one of the machine guns, or one of a pair that was firing directly across the valley.
So that's what we call enfilade fire?
Enfilade fire.
For people that don't know, that's fire from the side?
Fire from the side, and if you come out here and you stand in our front garden, you get a fantastic view across the valley, and you will understand very, very quickly how easy it is to lose 2,500 soldiers in a fairly confined space. But when you have machine guns that are set in probably the most perfect positions, and then
they've been there for 2 years, haven't they?
I mean, most of La Boiselle, all on the surface completely destroyed, but underground, all the cellars, all the buildings, all joined up by reinforced tunnels, reinforced concrete tunnels, etc. So the German army living beneath ground, electricity, water supplies, cooking facilities, medical facilities, you name it, underground, which the British bombardment prior to July the 1st, 16, wasn't able to actually destroy. So actually where we're recording, while we're having a chat at the moment, this is a German communication trench that runs through our dining room with German barbed wire barricade basically sitting where Terry is, which is why he keeps moving around on his seat.
He's quite sharp, some of the barbed wire I'm sitting on.
So it really is the heart of the 1916 Battle of the Somme.
So the village of La Boiselle wasn't taken on the 1st of July, because those that know La Boiselle, we've got the Loch na Garr crater, which we've mentioned and we talked to Richard Dunning about a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
That prevented the village from being taken, but it wasn't until a few days later that this area was taken at La Boiselle, is that right?
See, it's July,
the 3rd, was it?
July the 4th.
4th.
The village is finally captured, and in that capture there are various VC actions.
Oh, right.
Which occurred, and unfortunately July the 14th for our sister village across the valley of Ovillers to be captured, such as the strength in the and depth of the German defensive system here. So what should have fallen within probably 30 minutes,
that was the plan,
that was the plan, 30 minutes turns into 4 days for La Boiselle and 14 days for Ovillers
over the road. And you briefly mentioned there about VC winners. So you've got some sites in the village then. You've got some notes there to tell us a little bit about one or two of these VC winners.
We're very proud of all the lads that fought here, whatever rank and whatever army, whatever nation. And it always seems difficult to pick out the three VCs because there were so many brave actions, many of which didn't get reported, but we are proud of the three VC awards that were made for action in La Boiselle. So we've... David, do you want to talk about that?
So we've got... our first one is... I've had to write the name down because it's such a long name. Sir Adrian Paul Ghislaine Carton de Wiart, who was awarded the Victoria Cross somewhere close to the church in La Boiselle. So if you come to the village... the church rebuilt on its original foundations. So Carton de Wiart, with one hand, he just lost his other hand in the Boer War.
So he'd already lost one hand.
Lost
he hadn't
one
been
hand.
Discharged from the army. Was yeah. back here leading his men into action. Senior officer.
Lost an eye before joining.
Wow! So he's lost an eye and an arm.
He's called lucky.
Because he hadn't lost his other eye.
Exactly. leading his men forward, Germans counterattacked on the afternoon of July the 4th, and he led his men through the trench, pulling the pins of the hand grenades out with his teeth, and then throwing the grenades with his good hand.
Wow! And so he's actually not just he's leading his men. He's got a bag of bombs. He's pulling the pins out with his teeth, and then throwing them with his one arm.
Yeah.
And these guys behind him are going, well, if you're mad enough to do it, we'll follow you.
Yeah, that's true leadership, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
So, what happened to him?
He eventually died of old age.
So he survived?
He survived. Yeah.
So he's attacking the Germans, leading his men, bag of bombs, pulling the pins out. Germans are firing out. They're on their counter-attack, so they're defending, really. Mm-hmm. And he's survived all that.
Survived all that, went through the Second World War, got shot down, taken prisoner, shot in the face, his stomach, his ankle, tunnelled out of a POW camp, and bit off his own fingers when a doctor refused to amputate them.
Oh, off the one good hand.
Of the one good hand. So he, and this is probably slightly controversial, it certainly was a few years ago when it became headline news, he wrote in his autobiography...
Which is called A Happy Odyssey. It's worth seeking out.
A Happy Odyssey.
A Happy Odyssey.
I'm going to have to look for that one.
Frankly, I enjoyed the war. The camaraderie of the men was exceptional.
We do hear this a lot, don't we? A lot of soldiers do say, despite what happened, this was the best time of their life. Well, that's an extraordinary picture that you've got there.
Well, and the artist's impression of it.
Artist's impression. He looks like a leader, doesn't he?
He has an eye patch.
And he looks like the sort of bloke that you would follow.
Oh,
follow
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, just his name alone, you should win an award for that.
Yeah. We're trying to spell it as well.
But he's lived until, what date did you say?
1963.
So he's into his 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After everything, Boer War, First World War, Second World War.
Yeah. Wow. But there's an interesting family postscript that I only discovered a few months ago, actually, because new records become available all the time. And here we are in La Boiselle. Carton de Wiart awarded his VC for action at the church. And I found a connection to my maternal grandmother, Eva Sparks was her name, and she's shown in the 1911 census as working as a parlourmaid in Adrian Carton de Wiart's home in Hove.
You're joking.
No.
There's no such thing as a coincidence on the song, is there?
So my grandmother...
This could be the reason why you came to La Boiselle.
Well, strange things happen here, and we just wonder if there's somewhere somebody's telling me something.
Because I wrote down here, why La Boiselle? And there wasn't really an answer other than
there isn't really an answer, but...
This is the answer,
the property and the location. And I think my grandma Eva, she died a while ago, but I remember her as a little girl.
You didn't know her?
I knew her till I was the age of 11, and she was a parlourmaid to Adrian Carton de Wiart's family, and he's shown as the head of the household on the 1911 census.
That's the connection. That's why you're here, isn't it?
I think that's probably why we're here.
Yeah.
But there are two other VCs that were awarded in the village, David.
Yeah, so we've got another one as Private Thomas George Turrell.
So we've gone from senior officer down to private.
Down to private, and again... Tom Turrell, if you ever see, or Google him, find a photograph of him, a big, stocky man. You'd want him...
on your side.
On your side in the trench. And he's awarded the medal for bringing his injured officer off the field, probably behind the church, and covered the officer's body as the Germans counterattacked, and the Germans were bayoneting anything lying on the surface. Oh. And they bayoneted... Thomas in his back. Thomas never moved. The counterattack is forced back, and then under cover of darkness, Tom picks up the officer and drags him back along the road from Contalmaison on into the top end of La Boiselle, where the officer is taken off to the clearing station, but sadly dies of his wounds later that night.
Right.
And for that, Tom was awarded the VC, and again he died of old age. He was aged 79 and he died in 1964.
Another splendid photo, which we'll put on my website, terrystours.co.uk, of Tom there, proudly wearing his service medals and his Victoria Cross in old age.
Absolutely.
And then there's a picture there. Is that with his daughter?
That's
with his
daughter.
With his daughter, who was called Lillian May.
Is that the day he's gone to get
his Victoria Cross at Buckingham Palace.
Wow. So far then, we've got two Victoria Crosses. Both men have survived.
Absolutely.
Then of course, no, you know what's going to happen next, don't you? So our third chap.
He's a posthumous one, isn't he?
Posthumous.
We do, and we're looking at a photo. He's such a fresh-faced, handsome young man, as so many of them were.
But he's an officer. How old?
This is Thomas Ord, Lord of Wilkinson.
Yeah.
And he actually is a bizarre thing. His family moved to Canada when he was 18, and then... he decided to come back, join the army, and again during an attack on La Boiselle on July the 5th, because the Germans so desperate to retake this spur of La Boiselle, he held off the attack, told his men to get back into the safety of the the trench, again, very close to the site of the church. He held off the attack. As soon as he saw his men were at a place of safety, he stood up and started to make his way back when a German sniper put a bullet through his back and was said that the bullet exited via his heart.
Oh.
His men then left the trench to go and pick up his remains. But then came a heavy German battery. And his remains were lost.
So they couldn't get him.
Couldn't get him.
They knew he was dead. They respected him so much.
Yeah,
they wanted to bring his body back to be part. Yeah.
So he's now commemorated on the memorial at Tiefau.
And he was just 22 when
22,
he died.
22, and again, the photo which I put on the website, he looked so young and, as you say, fresh-faced, completely the opposite to the lieutenant colonel that we looked at earlier.
And I think just touching on something you said earlier, Terry, I mean, why are we here? Mm. Well, though those three actions can be seen from number 56.
Yeah.
From the actual property, from the back garden.
And we can see Tiefau as well.
Yeah.
From the bedroom that I'm in. And we can also see the Auvillet Military Cemetery, where there are so many stories in there. Mm. But also notice one of them that came from Auvillet, from the Mash Valley opposite, and that's Lieutenant Colonel Sanders.
Oh, Sanders, yes.
Which is a story. People have told me, and I've read in the past, that these senior officers, these generals, lieutenant colonels, didn't care about their men. Well, let's look at the story of Lieutenant Colonel Sanders, then, that was leading his men here on the 1st of July in Mash Valley. What happened to him?
So Sanders, he's reconnoitred the position. He understands the massive extent of no man's land that is Mash Valley. It's about 900 metres between the British.
It's one of the widest expanses of no man's land on the 1st of July, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he knows, his fear is, if the German machine gun positions haven't been taken out, as his men move across that open ground, they are liable to be cut down. And sure enough, off they go. The bullets start hitting them.
He was with the Middlesex, wasn't he?
His Middlesex.
Middlesex Regiment.
And he basically was wounded, leading his men forward, wounded five times. Later said he wished he had died alongside his men.
Because he'd never had a moment's peace, had he? No sleep.
No sleep. And so he was a lieutenant colonel, and September the 6th, 1916, he puts a revolver to his head and pulls the trigger. Unfortunately, it's only on September the 13th, nearly a week later, that he actually dies.
Wow.
So he suffered the loss of his men, the guilt, and then to suffer in a hospital bed, slowly dying of a self-inflicted wound.
Huh.
It's one of the things we think about here is the mental health side of what the men went through. You've got Carton de Wiart. He enjoyed the war, using his quote, the camaraderie of the men, and I'm sure that kept a lot of them going. But you also have to remember how much suffering there was, how much mental anguish to be a leader of men or to be just in a platoon alongside men and to see the things that they had to go through.
Mm.
It took its toll, not just physically, but mentally as well.
Yeah.
I think it
just proves that these senior officers, not only were they leading from the front, they weren't in these chateaus 30 miles behind, but they actually did care about their men, and he's a fine example of that, isn't he?
Indeed.
And, you know, often whenever I go across into Mash Valley, I stand there and think of Sanders, because he didn't die there, he was wounded there,
that's right.
But he was still a casualty of the Somme nearly 3 months later.
That's right.
And again, we have a photo of him here, and his eyes, even in the photo...
He's looking at us now, isn't he?
He looks...
It's haunted.
He does. That's the word I was looking for, David. Yeah, he looks haunted.
Oh, that's incredible, isn't it? So we also mentioned a couple of times Loch Na Garr Crater. What is your role with the crater? I believe you're now trustees of the crater.
Well, we think the crater looks after us in many ways. It's one of the reasons that we're here, having first visited it about 30 years ago. And we've always taken a role in trying to look after it, maintaining it where we can. Even when we lived in the UK, we used to come over and help.
And help since Richard Dunning, who is the owner that we talked about a few weeks ago.
That's right.
And you know Richard, he's a personal friend.
Yeah.
And he comes over to the Somme regularly and comes here. And then he asked you to you're here, you're on site.
Absolutely.
Aren't you?
First, it started with us being his unofficially, his kind of eyes and ears on the ground, because we're, you know, 5-10 minute walk and we're at Loch Nagar Crater. So if he had any concerns, if, you know, a problem there, or just to keep an eye on the place, you know, any maintenance that needed doing, we're in the right place to help. And our relationship with Richard and the Loch Nagar Foundation has evolved over time, and we were honoured to be asked to become trustees of the Loch Nagar Foundation last year. So we formally accepted both of us to be trustees, which means that we want to be part of the team that carries on looking after that special place, which is such an open wound that, I know Richard talked about it, that signifies the suffering, but also now the peace and the reconciliation that we need to take from that place of suffering. So our ongoing... And actually, Terry, we've just come back from a walk up to Loch Nagar on a beautiful April afternoon, and it's a lovely little walk, isn't it?
And I'll tell you what I've noticed as well. I've been to the Somme several times since the end of the restrictions after the COVID crisis. And I've been up there, and there's been no one there but me, mm-hmm. whoever I've been with. Mm. But today, there was a coach there, there were some people on motorbikes, and there were some people in a car that were British visitors. Yeah. People are now returning to the Nagar Crater and to the Somme in general, and I think that's one of the most encouraging things, especially on a beautiful day like today.
That's right.
Now, people can actually contribute and help with the upkeep of the crater by buying memorial plaques, can't they, that surround the crater. They're available again now, I believe.
Yeah. They are. The plaque team, as we call them, we've got a team of volunteers who are responsible for getting the plaques ordered and then coming onto site here at Loch Nagar to place the plaques. And you can help by donating... and having a plaque to somebody that you want to commemorate. In terms of, the only restriction is it needs to be somebody who served in some way.
So not necessarily died, do they?
Not necessarily died. It could be served. As you walk around Loch Nagar, there are plaques to nurses and Australians and all ranks, Germans, French, all nationalities, which is really encouraging to see. So, if you visit the Loch Nagar Crater Foundation website, there is a page there about donating and getting a plaque for somebody that you wish to commemorate.
Fantastic. Really is the work that's going on. I know you've got a working weekend coming up in June, is it?
Early June. It normally happens in May, but it's happening in June. Now, there hasn't been any heavy maintenance at the crater for 2 years because of COVID, more than 2 years.
But it's not in bad condition, though, is it?
It's looking pretty good. Nature's kind of helped look after it, and David and I have been up with our clippers occasionally and to help trim the hedge. But there's kind of as many volunteers as possible are going to come over for a long weekend in June and get it looking shipshape. Because although it's a hole in the ground. It's amazing how much care it needs, from hedges, actually strimming the crater itself, painting the benches or revarnishing the benches. There's always something to do, so any willing hands are always welcome.
Yeah, that's great. And COVID, of course, can't do a podcast without talking about COVID. How has that affected you here? I know in the early days you could only walk 1 kilometre and only be out for an hour, so strict with the French rules. Yeah. How has that affected you and your business?
Well, I'll start. I'm sure David will chip in. But it was obviously very strange when no guests, and it was the first time since we've been here, we're in our 10th year now, that, you know, no guests.
It's been 2 years, really.
Yeah, with nobody coming through our door. So, well, first of all, David and I only had each other to rely on, and the local community, who I have to say are very supportive.
Yeah, but that meant you had to stay indoors with David.
I had to stay indoors with David.
And she's a lucky girl for that.
but I'm a positive person, and the positive out of that is it was the first time we were able to stop, and I can hear through the window here the birds singing.
I know you went on lots of walks.
We went on loads of walks.
Some Facebook Lives,
we did Facebook Lives. We tried to keep everybody in touch with what we could see, and to say the Somme is still here and it will be here for when you come back. Yeah, in the early days, we were restricted to 1 hour and 1 kilometre from home. The good thing from here, it means we can go to Auvillers Cemetery. Mm. In one direction, we
can go
to...
That's exactly 1K, isn't it?
It's 1K. We can go to Lochnagar, which is just less than a kilometre in the other direction.
Yeah.
And so we were not short of wonderful tracks and places to walk. So from that point of view, we made the most of it and probably got a bit fitter because of it, enjoying all the fresh air. But from a business point of view, it was really hard not having guests. We enjoy the company of our guests, but we got through it. We're still here, and you know, we're going from strength to strength, and we've got a good diary of guests coming through this year.
It's filling up, isn't it?
To see.
Yeah.
I don't know if you wanted to add anything, David.
Yeah, I think it was the first time in to draw the positive from it. I know, you know, there's a terrible downside in the number of people that died and etc. But from the positive, it's the first time in our working lives we had to stop after 40-odd years working in sales and goodness knows whatever else, to be forced to just do nothing. And that gave the opportunity to actually look at what we have here, appreciate finally what happened here over 100 years ago, and to actually look at this landscape with a completely different eye now, and to try and understand the topography. And as the restrictions were slowly eased, we could travel out further and we could go and explore areas that we'd never been. We'd never had the chance to go and see.
On your doorstep.
Yeah,
that's right.
So we used to rely on our guests coming back and explaining, you know, what happened, which is fantastic because that's how we learn. But yeah, there was a massive upside to it because we got to binge watch an awful lot on Netflix, and I actually managed to start reading some of the books.
You've already got about thousands of books here.
I started to start reading again.
And then you started the Teepvale Memorial was being restored, and you had the scaffolders were here.
Just over a year ago when Teepvale restoration started, the company responsible for the restoration wanted to put up some Belgian workers, scaffolders, so we had them here. Sort of this time last year, really, and again, that they were very welcome. They were wonderful guys, and it allowed us to stay in touch with what was happening at Teepvale. And I have to say, everybody who's worked on Teepvale all throughout this year has worked so hard in all weathers. On a beautiful day like today, it's easy, but these guys are there in the middle of a December rainstorm when the wind is blowing a gale, and they're very proud of what they're doing to restore Teepvale to its former glory.
Mm. So they were from Belgium, weren't they?
They're from Belgium.
So they probably understood a bit about the Great War.
They did.
And then in recent times you've had another team.
Yeah, we've had a team of stonemasons, some of whom have been Belgian, some have come further afield from Romania, but live in Brussels. And so they've been staying with us during the week over the winter, as they've been doing the very intricate stonework, not the re-engraving of the name panels, but there is a lot of stonework. There's if you can imagine Teepvale, there are the wreaths of honour, which have the names of the battles. They've needed careful restoration. Other parts of the Portland stone, and what's the other stone, David?
Masani,
that's right. We know about the Portland. There's this other specialist stone called Masani,
I've never
and they're
heard
specialists.
Of that.
Masani, but yeah.
You learn something every day.
You do. Every day is a learning day.
So they've again, we've been privileged to see the progress of the stonework, and work still continuing. But one leg of Teepvale has been cleared of scaffolding now, and it's the north side that is exposed to the elements that still needs.
So there's still no date, is there, as to when it's going to be finished?
No, and once, for example, one of the things we've learned from the stonemasons is some of the pieces they cut and then fix. They use a special resin-like glue to put pieces in. If it's less than 5 degrees,
it doesn't stick.
So they can't do it.
So they've got to wait for the better weather. And we still got frost. We saw that this morning.
We had a frost, beautiful day here, but we had a frost. So, not good for that.
No,
so
that's
why the work is continuing.
It will be, at some stage it will be finished, and then we'll be able to come and look at all those 72,000 names on the Teepvale Memorial again.
Indeed.
The people here on the Somme and in La Boisselle, what do they think when they see all these British visitors turning up and wandering around? Do they get it? What do they think to us? I've always wondered this.
Yeah, I don't know if we differ on this, but I'll say our friends and people that we know locally, they're actually really honoured and are very proud that people come to this, what is now a quiet corner of France. Mm,
very much so.
It's a rural community. And the fact that people come from all parts of the globe, not just from the
UK. They come from Australia, don't
we
they?
We have Australians, New Dutch Zealanders. People, I don't want to leave anybody out, but no. Canadians, the Commonwealth.
And beyond
like.
The Commonwealth, yes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We have a wonderful, one of the things we say is it's wonderful because the world comes to us and we learn so much just from people and their travel escapades. But so the locals are very proud that people come here and that they pay their respects and that people remember. And it really touches them. You know, they're not annoyed that there's, you know, coaches going by. And
well, it brings wealth, doesn't it? It brings business into the
local. Yeah, it does. It brings life and wealth. And somewhere like Albert, our local town, which is just, you know, a 5-minute drive away. But, the restaurants are glad to see people back. The Somme Museum is glad to see that people are slowly coming back because we rely on hate to use the phrase, but battlefield tourism, for want of a better phrase, people coming out. So, it's a very supportive community.
And I think one of the reasons, apart from the wonderful hospitality that you offer here, Julie and sometimes David, is that when we come here, you've now got this new dining room, and the view we can see across Mash Valley, we've got Sausage Valley. Why are they called Sausage and Mash Valley, Dave? Please explain.
It is a food question for me, right? Originally, a German observation balloon, which is shaped like a sausage, flew above a valley where today Loch Nagar Crater is. And of course, British trench humour, they decided to call, well, hang on, there's a valley and there's a sausage flying above it. We'll call it Sausage Valley.
Had to be called Mash Valley then, didn't it?
Yeah. Of course, it goes with it, doesn't it? It's like Fred and Ginger, fish and chips. I don't know what else.
So on that first day then, on the 1st of July 1916, we look out there and there is a memorial to the Northumberland Fusiliers, the stone memorial bench here. What happened? They came across those hills, did they, into Sausage and Mash Valley?
Yeah, you've got the 34th Division, who are basically Tyneside Scots, Tyneside Irish, etc.
So these are Scots and Irishmen living in the North East.
Living in the North East, joined up.
A lot of them miners or that kind of community. Yeah.
But a community, as Judy says, you know, worked together, played together, drank together, the pals, battalions. And so they come off to France and they're standing up on the Tara Usna ridgeline, the two hills before you enter Albert. And that's their jumping off point. Basically, if you come to La Boiselle, it's very close to the Poppy restaurant, if anybody knows that. And that's where they move from, and within probably an hour between the Poppy restaurant and the edge of Loch Nagar Crater, there are 6,500 British casualties.
Which is the highest percentage, isn't it, for any division on that day and first?
It is.
And as Richard Dunning often calls it, you know, it's the bloodiest square mile on the Western Front.
A lot of them get cut down before they even got to their front line?
Even before.
They're coming across. If we stand here and we look out from number 56 across the hills there, they got silhouetted against the...
Everything is... It was a bright morning, bright sunny morning, 1st of July, and they just got mown down before they got very
before they
far
even
at
got,
all.
For many of them, it would have been their first day in battle because they were Powell's battalions. Including George Nugent, of course, whose body was found
at the crater
in 1998 at the crater.
That's right. Yes.
His remains were discovered at the crater. And he's since been reburied in Obelaer Cemetery.
A man was walking around the crater, I believe, and saw a boot sticking up.
And
then George had engraved his name onto his razor.
Exactly,
a very personal object. Yeah. They found the whole skeleton, didn't they?
Got the whole skeleton.
Commission excavated, and then he's been taken to Obelaer in the year 2000.
He was reburied in 2000.
Family there?
Yep.
Yeah. July 1st.
The amazing thing about that, I always think, is that Mrs. Nugent, back home in Newcastle, had got no idea to her dying day what had happened.
Where her husband was.
He was on Teat Vale. He'd just gone missing, along with so many others on that day. But, you know, all those years later, he was found, and now he has a final resting place in Obelaer Cemetery, which we can see from the bedroom that I'm sleeping in across there in Mash Valley.
We would say this, but it's because we live here, but Elvelers is kind of we call it our home cemetery. We have lots of favourite cemeteries for different reasons, but Elvelers will always have a special place in our heart. It's the place we could walk to during COVID. I get emotional thinking about it, actually. Yeah. It's the resting place of... didn't expect to get emotional. It's a resting place of over 3,500 men.
So many of them unknown.
60% roughly unknown. There are some French graves in there too, because this was a French sector before the British arrived here. So the French fought and died here in 1914 and 15. And it's a very special place with amazing views down the valley.
And its location... people that don't know, it's in the wide expanse of no man's land, but just before you get to what would have been the German wire, German barbed wire, and then you've got the village of Ovillet, and so many of the soldiers that are buried in there, not just from the 1st of July, but from the 3rd of July, when the second attack took place across Mash Valley in there, and it was the 2nd Devonshires that attacked from the other side of the road there. So people, I know there's a lot of people from Devon listen to this podcast, and that's where your men.
Lots of Devons in there. And men from Lincoln. We talk about the Pell's battalions. There's the Grimsby Chums who were also at the crater. Some of them are in the crater as well. Some of those Lincolnshire chaps are also buried in Ovillers. And it's one of those strange things that we know about Powell's battalions, but the Grimsby Chums is the only Chums battalion, only so-called Chums.
Chums, yeah.
Very good.
What else can we see from number 56 when we look out the window? I mean, the village has been rebuilt. We can see Teepvale,
Ovillers. We can see the Golden Madonna on the top of the Albert Basilica. She sparkles in the sunlight.
We saw it today. Could see it all over the Somme
She's
today.
She's like a beacon from wherever you are on the Somme battlefield.
So that's in the Albert, which was the British base town leading up to the Battle of the Somme in 1916.
That's right, major railhead there.
Major railhead behind the British lines. In 1915, the Golden Madonna on top of the Basilica had been hit by shell fire and was lying at a right angle. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And the soldiers thought that if ever that got knocked down, that would be the end of the war. Yeah. And then in 1918, lo and behold, the British knocked it off, didn't they? British shell fire knocked it off.
That's right.
And it's back there now. And again, it is like you say, a beacon. You can see it from all over the place.
Yeah.
That was a British base town. You can see that.
And there are, you can, on certain days, you can walk up inside the basilica to the viewing platform, which is just underneath. Yeah,
you can go right up there and look across the battlefields.
Yeah, you can get an amazing view if you want to climb up the 300 and whatever it is step. It's something that people don't think about doing, but it really is worth doing.
Oh, I've never done that.
Yeah, well, there we go. Next time, Terry, we'll get that organised for you.
And then at the back of your, if you have, how many rooms have you got here?
We've got five. We've got five rooms.
Yeah.
One's on the ground floor for anybody who can't manage the stairs, and then we have four upstairs.
One looks out across Mash Valley to the cemetery.
Two look out across Mash Valley.
You're in the corridor.
Three look out to the church. A back garden to the church and Lochnagar behind. When the trees aren't in a leaf, you can see Lochnagar from the back.
Yeah.
But whatever time of year, you can also see the 34th Division Memorial.
I was just going to say about
which, again, is not that well known and not well visited, but David talked about the Northumberland Fusiliers, the 34th Division, and how many men were lost. Well, there's a beautiful monument to the 34th Division just in the field behind us.
And there's an amazing photograph of the veterans that were there in the 1930s. And I'll find that picture and put it on the website, because when I look at that photo, the men in that photo look so old.
Yeah.
But they can't be.
No, they're not old.
They can't be in their 30s or 40s.
Yeah, but they're all there in their ties and jackets. Very smart. There we go.
There's that photo there.
Yeah.
But the flag's missing, isn't it, Neil?
Yeah, the flag is gone.
Someone pinched that, have they?
There was a wreath. She had a laurel wreath in her right hand.
Right.
And at some point, that disappeared.
Right.
The guys in the photo have put a flagpole up there for the photo.
Ah, right, for the photo, yeah.
But in the background to the photograph, you see the original farmhouse at number 56 and the stable block, which is now part of the new dining area.
So when was number 56 built then? Do we know?
Originally in 1923, the original farmhouse was one of the first buildings
that was then built after. Here. But then that's been pulled down, and then this building...
Not pulled down, no, it's been added. It was a small farmhouse to start with. It's, over the years, it's been extended and added to. But the original, with our original cellar that we've got, is 1923. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the original cellar then, those Germans that we talked about that were shielding, they weren't in that cellar?
No, because it wasn't built till 1923.
Of course, no. There, but there would have been a building here? Or
no,
were too far
no,
out
no, it was just fields.
Just fields.
Yeah,
right.
It was just fields. But,
right.
Yeah. But yeah, she's called the 34th Division. The French call her Le Madelon.
Oh, right.
So she's known locally as Le Madelon.
That is an amazing photo, isn't it?
Yeah, to see all these wonderful veterans. They've all got their badges on.
And they're smiling, aren't they? They're happy they've got their medals there.
Yeah.
Wonder what their stories are.
Their stories and remembering the men that they left behind. That's the thing. And it's lovely to see there's even a there must have been escorted by somebody French because there's a Republic Francaise flag there. So again, they would have been supported by the local community. What, probably the mayor
was
would
it
have
a date
escorted
on it? 36, is
1936.
So 3 years later... The Germans are back here.
Indeed, yeah.
4 years later.
Yeah.
They're back here.
Yeah.
So you have the tanks driving down the road.
Outside here.
Outside at the front door.
Ironic, isn't it? It's after all the bloodshed of 1916, and then it's, you know, La Boisselle is occupied again.
Well, the local community, the generations that... families have lived here for generations, and, yeah, they talk about they had it
they
three
remember
times.
It.
They remember... Well, nobody alive now remembers... No. 1870-71, the Franco-Prussian War, when they were here. And then again, First World War, and again, Second World War. So they kind of that lives long in the family's memories, yeah.
So just coming back to how you run this place, there's just two of you that do all the work.
There
and you
are.
Can have, how many rooms you say you got?
We've got five rooms, so we can have, if we've got a family and we'll have 11, because we've got one room that sleeps three.
But it's not just a bed and breakfast, is it? You're offering, one of the few establishments on the Somme that offer a wonderful four-course evening meal as well, which is the reason why I'm getting fat.
Yeah, it's coming up to dinner time.
It is.
But we do provide evening meals, and the ethos behind that is we know that if people are out all day exploring on the battlefields, they don't always want to go out again.
No.
So part of the... Part of what we want to offer, and hopefully we do offer, is an ambience around our dinner table with some good food, a glass of wine or a soft drink.
And we leave the battlefields out there, innit?
We leave the battlefields out there, and we come back and we socialise. We'll talk about all the things we've just talked about and swap stories and learn from each other. But we also have some fun.
Yeah.
We talk about all sorts of things, and you make friends. I know Terry's made friends here that he's kept in touch with, and... We've made some glorious friends.
You must have friends from all over the world now.
We do, that keep in touch, and we keep in touch. And we call them, actually, they're like the number 56 family.
Yeah. You do a newsletter every month, don't you?
We do a newsletter every month.
You've got a chicken?
We normally have more than one chicken. But
just make that clear, we normally have more.
Our chickens have died of old age, apart from one, Marge, who keeps going, and she provides
one egg.
You're
still providing?
Yeah. She provides an eggs. When we're busy... like we have been this week, she doesn't provide enough eggs for everybody. But we'll get a new batch of chickens because they're part of our family
too. They are, yeah. Daddy goes out and sings to them every night.
Absolutely.
Puts them to bed.
Luckily, I like cooking. David likes being a host, and it kind of works. But we do everything ourselves, from the maintenance to the laundry, cleaning the rooms, shopping, cooking, clearing up. We're usually the first up and the last to bed.
I know. I don't know how you do it.
We would not have it any other way.
Well, it's just like Basil and Sybil.
Often you hear David talking. For anyone that's been here, they'll know what I mean. David can be in here in the dining room where we are now, chatting to people, and he's supposed to have done the beans or the toast or something.
Yeah.
And we hear David coming from the kitchen.
The kitchen, yeah.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
There's usually David again a few minutes later,
and
then some banging and crashing.
That's right. I do give him a hard time, but
it works.
I have to say,
it?
I don't do all the cooking. David has his specialities.
What's your specialty, David? I know beans and toast are
anything red. Serious. Tomatoes and baked beans and toast. They are very difficult.
That's in the morning. What about in the evening?
I just eat it.
in the evening, David's responsible for setting the table, making sure everybody's got a drink of whatever they want, and yes. helps to serve.
And he's very good at it, aren't you?
Thank you.
Is, yeah. We're a team. You couldn't do this. We live and work together in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in our little bubble. You couldn't do it if you didn't get on. And while we banter, and our guests know that we banter with each other, we couldn't do without. We are like Basil and Sybil. We might bicker, but we kind of get on.
You need
really
a Manuel
well.
Then, don't you?
Yeah.
Perhaps David's Manuel as well.
He is Manuel as well, but we don't have any hamsters. Yeah.
No, the bat has all the rat.
Gosh,
so yes. What about the future? What do you think the future holds? You've got a very, very busy diary. I looked on, if people go on to number 50, so what's the website address?
It's www.number56 with the numbers 5 and 6, www.number56.co.uk. Or if you just Google search number 56, we're on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. Yeah. We have on our website an availability calendar, so that will show you what rooms are available when, and then just contact us. We're not on any booking sites. We prefer the personal touch, so it's very simple to contact us by email or phone or through our contact page, and we'd love to see you. What does the future hold, I think, was your question, Terry, in terms of...
Because I was thinking, the reason why I asked that question is that ignore the pandemic.
Yeah.
Between 2014 and 2018, the world and his wife came to the Somme in all sorts of different ways, with different groups and individuals. And then people wondered, even before the pandemic came along, would that be the end of people's interest in the Great War? Would they stop coming to the Somme? What have you found?
I think there will always be a core interest. Well, what we have found, though, first-time visitors... sort of come check us out, check the location, and then the next time we see them, they're bringing maybe their younger generation.
That's so important, isn't it?
It is, and so the stories are told, and you know, again, we whatever our customers want, we will do our best to meet their demands. So we, depending with, I think a 4-year-old is the youngest person we've had here, who. I met.
Did you cope with that, David?
I did. He actually had some very interesting views about things.
Four?
No, I was four. No, him and his dad came out, and I met them up in Newfoundland Park, and I took them around there. And
so you go and you take people out.
I'll take them. So we meet at certain key locations, and I do my little bit. So he's the youngest. We've had through to, I think it's 96.
96 is the oldest.
Is the oldest. Yeah. And again, he brought three generations of his family, and it really was handing the baton passing the baton on to the younger generation. And the amount of research that particular gentleman had done was extraordinary. But more than happy to share it around the table. And other guests who were a little bit shy suddenly got drawn into this extraordinary story. So I cannot see battlefield, as you said, it's a horrible phrase, battlefield tourism. I cannot see the numbers really decreasing in any way. And in a way, we're getting more of the Commonwealth coming out now as well. Mm. And again, bringing younger generation with them. At the same time.
It is exciting.
It's. I think a lot of people thought, 100 years, and that everybody will forget it, it'll drop off a cliff. No, it won't. If anything, it's going from strength to strength.
I think the other thing is, like I said, only a few months ago, I discovered about my grandmother and Carlton de Witt and the connection there. People are using tools online now, whether it be through Ancestry, other genealogy sites, and want to discover about their past and their family past.
Especially when people are retiring early.
Absolutely.
It's got more time to start researching their family
stories.
And
often there's a First World War connection. Often. Mm. So I think that interest will continue. So so we think the future's buoyant is a word that we use. We're never complacent, and we're always looking to be the best that we can, improve all the time. And we kind of, without... We are a bed and breakfast, but we want to
more
be...
More than that.
We are what you want, whatever you want us to be. We provide a homely, comfortable place that you can come and enjoy the battlefields, enjoy some good food in a unique, beautiful location, and meet some interesting people along the way. So whether that be we provide you a packed lunch as you go off exploring.
Yeah. The biggest packed lunches I've ever seen.
If you want us to do some research about a family member or you want to know about a specific cemetery or an action, we can help with that. And that's what keeps us fresh, because the more research that we do, the more we learn.
Because you do learn all the time, don't you?
You do. You never stop.
Everybody
says... We live here, but we're not experts. We just learn all the time.
No. Yeah. And I think the way I look upon this place, apart from being my second home, is that it's the gateway to the Somme, really, because we're bang in the middle of the battlefield.
That's right.
To the south, you know, we've got where there was some success on the 1st of July, and then to the north, we've got where it was mostly failure. We're bang in the middle of the Somme battlefield. We've got all these places to go and see and explore. We've got Teat Vale. So many places that are within walking distance. What this place is, it allows you to get and see all of these places of interest very, very easily, but also go and explore the other businesses that are here on the Somme. We said right from the beginning, I said, people remember in the first podcast, that I wanted this to be about promoting all of the businesses that are here on the battlefields. And this is just one, but it is a place where you can go and visit the museums, the cafes.
Absolutely.
You know, the Ulster Tower, we're going to go and talk to them tomorrow. There's so many other businesses to go and help here on the Somme. And it's great to be able to have this opportunity to come and promote them. Promote the Somme. We're promoting the Somme, really, aren't we?
Promoting the Somme, absolutely. Yeah. And there is so much. And even if you want to get away from the war, there's beautiful walks down by the Somme River. There's
we've been down there today.
Beautiful villages. We have lots of guests who come with their bikes in the back of the car and they go off cycling or walking.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful part of rural France. In a way, forget Sailing Arrête, Cerisy Gaye, Suzanne. There's some beautiful walking and cycling.
Which are behind the British lines, going down onto the French lines, in the cemeteries down there. But if you want to get, as I say, you want to get away from it, you can walk along the river, can't you? And
That's right.
I'll tell you what, it's tea time.
It is, coming up.
It's beans and tomato.
Get a wiggle on. No, there's some food going to be served in about
We're going to be doing
hour.
That.
Yeah, we've got some lovely guests here today.
So thank you very much for that.
No, thank you.
Absolutely thank you, Terry, for the chat.
We'll see what happens in the future.
We look forward to it.
See you soon.
Thank you, David.
Or Basil.
Basil. So that's the end of this week's podcast. And once again, a big thank you to Julie and David at Number 56 for their time last week. We had a fantastic stay there. We were there for 3 days. We went to the battlefields of Neuve Chapelle to begin with and recorded a podcast there with Diego Blondel, one of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission gardeners. That'll be coming up in a few weeks' time. Next week, I'm going to be out on the Second World War battlefields of Normandy, the D-Day beaches, and inland as well. And I shall be guiding for Ledger battlefield tours. So that will be a new experience for me this year. It will be 4 years since I last guided for them, with the pandemic being in between. So I'll report back, see how we get on that. It just leaves for me to say thank you very much to everybody who's taken the time to listen to these podcasts over the last few weeks. And I especially wanted to thank someone from Australia, from Melbourne in Australia, who contacted me to say that he's an avid listener of podcasts that are produced by Paul Reed, Matt Dixon, Peter Hart and Gary Bain. And he just started listening to mine. And he said that he operates a small charitable business in Australia. And what he does, he sits at his desk and listens to history podcasts all day, as he's probably working on his own. And he's got a relative of his wife that's buried near Ypres. And he said, and I quote from his email, "Whilst physically I'm located a very long way away from the battlefields of Belgium and France, your podcast is another that will make them feel so much closer to me." And that for me, it made me feel very, very satisfied that there is some point in me sitting here, as I've said before, alone, talking into a microphone, wondering whether anyone's listening. But that shows me that they are. And as long as they do, I'll continue to produce these podcasts. But wherever you are in the world, I hope to see you on the battlefields before long. Signing off for now. And once again, I would like to pay tribute to all of the soldiers, the Victoria Cross winners, from Les Boisselles in particular, that earned their Victoria Crosses within the confines of the village close to Number 56. And this podcast is dedicated to those very, very brave men.